are here.
But we were having technical difficulties.
We're always having technical difficulties. I'm starting to lose my crap. If we don't find like somebody who knows how to do this, if you're out there and you know, actually what's great is nobody's out there. So we're talking to nobody. We're talking to Ashmi. So maybe she knows if she can be.
Well, that's for start. We haven't had anybody get on here.
No, we have to wait a few seconds, but we need to find a producer. Like I cannot be doing this tech stuff. And now that we're on a schedule that is Sundays.
Consistent
Sundays, and Jason's not here a lot of those times. And I don't want him to have to do this job.
This
should be his space, and we're in his space, and we need to get a studio set up, and we need.
Anything else you want to complain about on the Sunday?
It's not complaining. Yeah. It's that's what you always say whenever I say anything.
The first guess that we could have could be scat, but
you always.
Look, we're doing the best we can with the limited time that we have, and so. You know, as you guys know, this isn't our career. We do this because we want to help. And, you know, the technical side of things is never the easiest thing to deal with. But we are flying by the seat of our pants. And we managed to have a much better camera setup than normal, which is always.
I don't know why you think that.
I think so.
Well, no, we happen to have a good camera.
We have a good camera and good lighting now. So that's obviously a good thing.
I'm not complaining, Scott. Peter always says I'm complaining when I ever exhibit an opinion or say something. To him, it's complaining.
Mario,
women beware.
We didn't even have an opportunity. We had a last minute guest switch today. We're not going to say who switched or not because we're not going to do that to friend. But that's the beauty of live streaming. You never know what's going to happen.
Okay, well, so. I do feel bad about that. Well, yeah, we didn't have. I feel bad now. I have to go. Hello.
Oh well. And you know, they are now airing Seinfeld 4 hours on, I don't know how many days a week.
Yeah, no, it's always on. But no, you know what, guys, because this is not like a professional gig for us. It's just us. So at any given moment, like sometimes we remember.
Two great episodes yesterday, The Sponge and The Pick were on.
Is he sponge worthy?
Well, hey, listen, I ain't getting into that.
But yeah, sponge worthy is a.
So as you guys know, obviously, this is actually a perfect time to bring on our first guest, Ashmi Sheth, who is running in New York's 10th congressional district. And why is that? Because the Kyle Rittenhouse case just concluded. And obviously, you know, it was a very controversial case to say the least. But unfortunately, the gentleman that Ms. Sheth is running against is one of those, we'll just call spotlight seeking Democrats. And more or less likes to put his foot in his mouth and decided that what I like to say about these types of representatives is that they present a net negative, meaning that when they try to wax poetic about things that they really don't know what they're talking about, they end up hurting the cause for progressive change. They end up emboldening the political right. And that's what her opponent.
They're feckless.
They do tend to be. And so.
They're feckless people.
Guys, smash that like button, share. We're just getting started.
All right, guys, Scat in the comments. Scat's just pushing your buttons. He's a fairly decent troll. Just don't engage.
Don't engage.
Seriously,
he doesn't. Trolls, guys.
Don't let him taunt you about Kyle Rittenhouse. Okay, it's not worth your energy.
So without further ado, we are very pleased to welcome for the first time an amazing activist and somebody who we have already heard is doing amazing work in New York's 10th district, and we'll discuss the borders of what that represents in New York City, because obviously that's it's amazing how much ground you can cover in a very small space because of how.
They definitely have a canvassing advantage.
And hopefully I have been saying her name right. Ashmi Sheth, welcome to Generation with you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Did I say it right? Am I at least pronouncing it correctly?
No, thank you for asking. It's actually Ashmi, like Usher. I've been saying that
Ashmi.
Since I was a kid. Yeah.
So it should be a U, but it isn't, is what you're saying.
Well, in Indian culture, so I'm first generation Indian American, and A is always pronounced as and a double A is pronounced as ah. So.
That's really interesting.
Aha moment.
So welcome on. I unfortunately am not aware of all the cool candidates running all over the place, but then when it comes up on the calendar, I go and I look them up. And so obviously you are an activist and a non-corporate candidate, but you know, what do you think is different enough? What is going to be the difference to be able to oust a sitting incumbent, which we know is, it's really, it's daunting. It's very daunting. And especially once you get on their radar.
Yeah, I had so much to bring today to the conversation. I think the first thing is, like you mentioned, the district itself is the smallest geographic district in the entire country. So when it comes to canvassing, it's an entire different ballgame than living in the suburbs, right? It's a super dense environment. It's the west side of Manhattan, parts of Brooklyn. It is super gerrymandered. Because
I was going to say, how can it be west side of Manhattan and Brooklyn?
And in fact, parts of the district are just one street. And as we know with the census, every 10 years we have redistricting and our district will look different and the lines will be redrawn. And I'll talk about this a little bit later. But when that happens, it's not that those lines are going to create even more clusters of, you know, where people live. In fact, we're seeing it's going to be even more gerrymandered. And that's something that's concerning to me. But yeah, in terms of our advantages and what we've been doing on the ground. So I launched 8 months ago. I am a working class person. I used to regulate big banks at the Federal Reserve. I left my job to run. What we have seen in New York City are the rise of monopolies. People are priced out. You'll go and see studio apartments with, you know, a tiny little bathroom, no kitchen, no in my apartment, we don't even have a microwave. And they'll cost $4,000 a month. And it's just, how do you live like that, you know? And I think it's just something that's been exacerbated by years of neglect. And so really what we're running on is a campaign of care, because there hasn't been care to the city. We can see it falling apart in front of us. And for us, it's really, you know, what's happening is I'm the only one challenging Nadler right now. And so that's a really big opportunity, unlike other districts, even in New York City alone. And so when we're thinking about, you know, running to the left of somebody who does take corporate PAC money, who says they're progressive, but has, you know, hurt LGBT causes in 2007 and has enforced mass surveillance on Black and brown people in just last year, to me, that's a really big concern. So for us, it's like we're running a genuinely, you know, grassroots campaign. We're on the ground every single day. And I'll tell you about our model really quickly, if that's okay. It's
sure.
So all of our platform is written by the people in our community. So we've had over 15,000 people write policy with us. Because I felt like when I was growing up, my mom and dad had no exposure to politics, were hurt by the system in so many ways. And it's like, why didn't we ask them what they needed or what was the best solution for what they were going through? And I think that's always just been something in my mind is how do we move the needle and allow people to participate in government again and feel like their ideas are actually valued. And so that's the model that we created. And that's why we've been able to get to where I am right now.
I think that's awesome. But you really remind me when we first started the campaign, when we first started doing it, that's exactly what mm-hmm. my thought was. And I was calling it platforms, right?
We call it crowdsourced. Yeah. Community right. build.
And that was the idea, is like having a forum to mm-hmm. create the platform. And I think that's so smart. And I think that's when you know that somebody is really representing their community. And I think it's also important when you say having a campaign of care, because we also ran a service-based campaign. Mm-hmm. But more than that, what you're also doing, which is, this is the bonus. I mean, I know it's not necessarily the why you're doing it, but the bonus is when you start showing people what they're supposed to have,
exactly
what their representative is supposed to be doing. Because we thought the same thing. I said, you want to be the representative. And you end up doing what should be their job. Yep. And it's sad. Like, why do our elected representatives not have volunteers out serving the community? I mm-hmm. did it as a candidate. Mm-hmm. How easy is it? You give the kids.
I have heard, you know, just going on the ground, I think the beauty of being a candidate is no matter what the environment and circumstances are, you are out there, you are meeting people, you are pushed in so many ways. Like, I've been an organizer for years, but now this is a very intentional process of making sure that, are you registered to vote? What's going on in your home? And I've walked into so many homes where stories, just horror stories of people saying, my stub hasn't been repaired in 14 years, or my small business through COVID, I called Nadler's office 30 times and no one ever responded. And it's like, what are we doing with all of that pent up, you know, frustration and anger at what's going on? And why do we have to just swallow it and say, okay, that's fine. You know what I mean? So for us, it was really about, like, there are people that can actually take action, that can do what they want, that they say they're going to do. And I haven't seen that in this district. There are people that have never gotten a knock from, you know, Nadler or anyone from Nadler's team since he's started 30 years ago.
And you know what else? They also have noticed that their lives have been getting materially worse and not better. So when an incumbent sits there and is like, well, but I know what I'm doing. I've been here. I have the experience. Yeah. That's why we're in the mess that we're in. If you were good at your job, then people wouldn't be suffering in the way that they're suffering.
We're also noticing the fact that Nadler has been a representative in the 10th Congressional District. Obviously, it's moved around, during the census years, but he has been a representative of Western Manhattan and I guess what you would call the shoreline of Brooklyn for 30 years. And again, he's never challenged. It wasn't until... friend of the show, Lindsay Boylan, and a few others decided to challenge him this last election cycle. But generally speaking, you know, we see this in a lot of different places. They are not only in gerrymandered districts, but nobody. And we notice that this is much worse on the Democratic side than on the Republican side.
Yeah.
It is considered a non-starter if you try to unseat a long-term incumbent. It is just one of those things where it's like an unwritten, oh, no, you can't do that. No, you can do that and you should do that.
It's our fight. You know, there's so many people that come up to me and I hear so much support, first of all, in this district to have somebody new in office. There's so many, there are other people that come up to me and they're like, why are you running? How dare you? Like, you have such a big ego. And I'm like, this is not coming from a place of ego. It takes a lot to leave your job, to not have health insurance. I'm a person with a disability and I gave that up. And how are we supposed to survive? So this is not coming from a place of ego. It's just a place of necessity. It's a place of survival. And I really feel, and a place of representation. And so I feel like for us, as we're building the campaign and people have the audacity to come to me and say, you can't do this. I tell them, no, this is my right. It's my right to run. It's our right to compete, to create healthy democracies. And that's our job, you know, is so for us, as you mentioned, the fact that this seat hasn't been contested seriously until last cycle to me is really concerning. But what we're doing is we're paving the way for people to be able to contest and to expand the base and to show people that we need new representation in this seat. And so all the work that was done last cycle is going to help us build, you know, for this cycle. And that's really important. And that's something that I honor. Yeah.
Obviously, there are three components to running a successful campaign. One of them is likability. The other is the ground game. And three, of course, is fundraising. And so what has that been like for you? Obviously, you're a very affable person. Certainly, if you're in, like you said, one of the advantages to running for federal office in a major city is that you typically don't have a lot of distance you have to cover. You have a lot of doors to knock, for sure. But you do have the opportunity to meet a lot of people. And obviously, having that ground game is essential. We saw what that was like for candidates like AOC, Jamal Bowman, Mondaire Jones, now Melanie DiRigo out in Long Island, and certainly yourself. And let's not forget our good friend Isaiah James, awesome guy. And that is he is in the 9th district. So my point is, it goes without saying that if you're going to be able to pull this off, you need to have a solid financial infrastructure. How has fundraising been going for you thus far?
Yeah, thank you for asking. And I am not an affluent person at all. So in fact, like when I was working 3 jobs at a time to, you know, even think about running and taking time off while I've been running. I am in the line for the food pantry. Like, we can't even afford groceries. So it's been really, really hard. But I will say, in terms of fundraising, because I don't have high net worth connections, it's truly running off of those $25, $5, $3 contributions that we've gotten. So we've had over 800 people contribute to the campaign in our first 2 quarters, and that we raised over $200,000. And it's just been brute force call time. It's been going door knocking. It's hosting events with people on the ground. I mean, that's what it takes. It's really just making sure that we're touching as many people as possible, you know, in their lives and saying like, hey, look, I'm here. I care about you. Please just, if you can give whatever you can. And you know, what I see is like, there are all these resources out there to fundraise. And it's just a really frustrating process as someone who's grassroots, because our time should not be spent as like telemarketers trying to get money out of people. Our time should be spent on the ground, writing policy with people. It should be about really understanding what the issues are and developing legislation around it. And it's just, I think, a frustrating process where even the people that are, quote, grassroots donors on these call time lists that are given to a lot of grassroots candidates, their net worth is like over $2 to $5 million. And it's just the system that's been created. And so for me, it was really important to increase and expand what donor bases look like. There are a lot of Asian Americans that don't give to, you know, people in office that have never really participated in the system. And so this was an opportunity for me to start just going to my communities and saying, look, one in five of us are Asian American here in our district. We have a role to play, and it's a serious one. So, yeah.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, obviously, we all see changing demographics. Like, that's a huge thing. And a lot of the people that have been sitting there have been sitting there so long, the people that are now comprising the district aren't really participating. And the few people that are lingering from their heyday are the people that come out and vote for them. So there is such a shift in demographics. So I'm curious, you know, what your district looks like in terms of, like, who supports Nadler? You know, like, who is that? Like, it's not the people are your people. They don't, or they just do because they don't, they just know that name, you know, whatever. But like, who, what does the demographic look like there?
Yes. I mean, our median age is 37. That's half of how old Nadler is. So, I mean, a lot of these people have never been exposed to Nadler, you know, like they've never, like I said, gotten a piece of lit or any of that. So for us, it was like, how do we appeal to this group of this demographic of people, which actually has responded really, really well to our campaign. Also, a lot of minorities, people with disabilities. We have a large group of veterans, people with disabilities in our district, students. We have, you know, Fordham, Pace. I went to Columbia, Barnard, all these universities that are here. So it was really just thinking about those bases. Now, the thing with those bases is like Nadler's base are people that have probably known him for so many decades and have consistently voted for him. So he's never really felt the pressure to expand his base as we've seen on the ground, you know, in real time. So what happens with all of these other people, the many others that don't vote, majority of people in our district do not vote, is that they haven't really had somebody go to them and say, hey, look, what do you need from us? I care about you. I want to make sure that you're represented. And so a lot of them, even if they are registered to vote, they have a lot of, you know, trust issues with who's there. So that's something that we're trying to address right now.
Yeah, I think that's smart.
Yeah. And I also think that this is something that we ran into when Jen ran for Congress. It's the same thing. Oh, I've known, you know, her.
Yeah, since she
like was pushing her babies in a stroller. It's like, yeah, that's in the early 90s. Like, you know, it's
what have you done for me lately?
Yeah, well, that should be.
I also just want to say, like, it's really, I feel like people need to expect more from their representative because right now it's like if they've gotten a photo with him, that's enough for them to say like, oh yeah, I've met him. And there's so many people that come to me and they're like, oh, but you know, what's wrong with Nadler? It's like, when's the last time you spoke with him? When's the last time you spoke with his team? And it just immediately helps them rethink the election and, you know, what's important about democracy. So, yeah.
Yeah, they don't really, they've never had their feet held to the fire enough that they actually have to do their job. And I try to tell people all the time, your representative is your employee. And the fact that they're so, they're so insubordinate. And it's like, that's how I look at Congress. Those are insubordinate employees. And I think more people need to understand that, you know?
Yeah, I don't want to be disrespectful too harshly to the congressman, but the reality is he is not capable of walking his district and knocking on doors and engaging his voters because he's just physically not capable of doing it.
And it isn't necessarily age. I mean, look at Bernie.
That's true. Because Bernie's put 80 and he can still campaign.
Well, I'm just saying. So it isn't just, it's not just age, it's effort.
And that's also, and again, and I think that that has a lot to do with it. I think that has a lot to do with, you know, the construct of big city politics. I mean, we saw a lot of that, you know, recently in the mayoral race. What was so interesting about the mayoral race is not that Eric Adams won the race, but the fact that so many of the city council candidates who were non-corporate, whether they were with the Sunrise Movement, whether they were with the Working Families Party, or whether they were working with DSA, and I think DSA had the most victories overall, there were a lot of victories for non-corporate candidates. Can you talk about what your experience has been like connecting with the grassroots organizations throughout the city that could ultimately help you win this thing?
Yeah, it's been really close ties. Most of our people are from those organizations that you just mentioned, even on our campaign. So, I mean, it is a circle. It is a space. Now, what I'm worried about is, like, we can't work against each other. So I think sometimes with New York City politics, there's so many Democrats, and you can see the full spectrum of what, you know, progressives versus socialists. So we have to really think about, like, how do we consolidate power and mobilize it. So that's something that we've started to see for sure. There are parts and pockets of the city that are moving much further out to the left, like Queens, Brooklyn, the Bronx, but Manhattan is a space that we really need to break. And I think that's something that most people are starting to see because Manhattan, even with the city council races and borough president races, you can see there were a lot of swaps happening. You know, somebody who's sitting in a seat was just switching to another seat. And they were doing swaps. So it wasn't really about necessarily new leadership, and though we have seen some of it in our district. But yeah, we've built, you know, in order to even run for such a large seat, we have to have a lot of relationships with people on the ground, district leaders, city council members, you know, existing city council members, newly elected members, state delegates, assembly. So for us, we've had to do that work. And I've been building for years. And so that's really something that's relational. But I think at the end of the day, it's like, how do we know A, what the district will look like? And how do we have the greatest clarity how do we organize everybody in that district as fast as possible? We have 8 more months left till the election. And so it's really pivotal time right now for me. And we have, you know, we have AOC's former field director. We have Bowman's former endorsements director. We have Bowman's fundraiser. I mean, those are real things that we have that need. And so we're building, but we just have to keep going. And endorsements are going to really ramp up in the next couple of months. So yeah, I'll let you know how that goes. You'll see it.
Yeah. I mean, one of the biggest issues, of course, is, you know, getting in with labor. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems that we have here is that union management is different than rank and file in terms of what they prefer. So for example, mm-hmm. the AFL-CIO here, they didn't even give me a screening, which is actually a violation of their own bylaws. And that's because they're in with Debbie, even though mm-hmm. she supports the TPP and, you know, she's horrible for labor. Mm-hmm. Where are you guys in terms of getting in with the unions, and like, what is their relationship with the current congressman?
Yeah, it's kind of similar to what you're saying. And it's something that, and I'm happy to talk about some of the challenges that we're experiencing as well. But yeah, I think for us, like my mother-in-law, for example, is part of SEIU, or, you know, we have directly people with disabilities that are unionizing, the freelancers union. So like we have all these different organizations that are considering the campaign, but I can't speak on their behalf yet. There's a lot of, you know, just meetings happening internally to sort out endorsements, union endorsements. But I can't really say more than that. I think just for us, as you know, I used to be I'm part of a union myself. I was in the Graduate Workers Union, and my wages were cut 40% in 1 year. And we had to organize to really find out what was next for us. So I think I've directly experienced the burden of losing 40% of my wages that were expected and having to then pull 2 more jobs to be able to figure out how to survive here. So I think that's just something that a lot of labor would respect. We also, you know, from the beginning have paid our staff from the start, you know, at least minimum wage, a livable wage in New York. And I think that's something that's really unseen with a lot of candidates who are working class, because, you know, we have to fundraise in order to pay. We're not really working with consultants. We're working with people who have suffered through COVID, many who lost their jobs, many people who had been going through depression. And those are the people that we were like, you know what, this is a space for you to feel like you can have a safe space to work and to thrive. And we've seen the difference. It's like when you give somebody really like empowering work to do, they end up doing it and they're extremely loyal and they really care about the movement. So we've been able to, you know, through COVID, there's a lot of hardship and grief, but we've been able to mobilize a lot of people, millennials, Gen Z, you know, all across different generations to say, this is a good time for us to come together. And yeah, so that's been our priority.
You've done an amazing job of recognizing that, not just with the fundraising dollars, but how to spend them properly. And that, of course,
exactly, not, yeah,
not just taking care of the staff, but the fact that you are bringing in people that are in the most important positions, of course, when it comes to field and con outreach, that have been part of campaigns that have won. Like that is immensely
important.
And, you know, obviously a lot of people talk about AOC's win and how significant it was, and it was, but, you know, Jamal Bowman's win was just as significant in terms of what he was able to do. And so having that type of a team around you is going to put you way ahead of what a first term time candidate normally would experience. Generally speaking, it's very hard to win on the first try. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we are huge proponents of is the New York Health Act. Now, of course, that's a statewide initiative, and it didn't really get enough traction during the mayoral race. But if you can talk about the importance of being a federal candidate and what the federal seat can do in terms of enacting influence, because much like how universal health care was passed in Canada, we feel that that's how it's going to happen here in the States.
Yeah.
It's going to happen in a major state like New York, and then it's just going to completely move out until eventually the momentum gets so big on Capitol Hill that they can't stop it.
And what I love about the Health Act is, you know, it's mental health care for all as well. And that's huge. So for us, I mean, when we're thinking about what have people said on the ground regarding healthcare, I'm a big proponent in Medicare for all, universal healthcare, especially as a person with a disability. So for us, what we did is we crowdsourced ideas around healthcare. We spoke with a lot of doctors, a lot of Black doctors, to talk about the maternal mortality crisis that we're seeing in hospital systems. We talked with several doctors regarding just how do we move patient health data from place to place and streamline it. And the biggest thing that kept coming up, and this is something that we've all seen, is just burnout, healthcare worker burnout. And how do we start creating an influx of healthcare workers? And that's something on a federal level that we should have started doing years ago. But that the way that a lot of students who are, you know, undergoing healthcare training, whether it's in medical school, it seems like there's such a scarcity of seats. And in reality, the number of seats that have been open for these students has not changed in decades. And so what's happening is there's greater competition, but we need more doctors as well. And that's where there's like this concern, especially in an urban environment like New York, where healthcare is so expensive, where so many people need healthcare every day. It's like we can feel the shortage here. And so that's something that I really want to address on a federal level, is just allowing people to relieve their debt burdens and to not create this scarcity of healthcare workers. My mom is also a healthcare worker. She went to community college and she's an ultrasound sonographer. And going through that program for her was an amazing opportunity. And I think just more people should be able to have that opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously one of the things that is a big issue and does prevent people from going to any sort of higher education is they can't afford to.
Yeah.
And especially, and I live in a medical family. My husband's a physician. We've been together since undergrad. And so I've seen the whole thing from start to finish. And we are very fortunate that his family was able to pay for him to go to medical school. But most people do not have that and cannot afford to go to medical school. And quite honestly, with the way that managed care has siphoned the profits off of everything, doctors aren't making the kind of money that people think they're making. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, there are some specialties in cosmetic stuff. I mean, there are that, but for the most part, it's not like it was. Mm-hmm. And yet they still have the same debt if they go to medical school. So it's definitely a scarcity problem. And it is even worse so for doctors of color. Mm-hmm. There are very few. Yeah, and that's a big part of why.
And you know, I'll also say as somebody who, you know, a lot of my family still lives in India, and this is something that even my own parents went through, is they went to school in India, but their degrees were not recognized here in the United States. And so they had to repeat their education. At that point, it was so expensive that they dropped out. They just couldn't finish. And so for us, it's like a very, what we've seen in my community is just that, is that when you have to repeat your education and they're not acknowledging that global education, and the qualifications for that are so steep, how will you get, you know, new diverse groups of people in these industries? Because that's really what also allows for generational wealth, is to be able to have equal opportunity for all. And that's what I'm running on, is really building a 21st century government and equal opportunity for all. And when you have something that costs $300,000 to get through, is that really considered equal opportunity? It's not, you know, so that's something we're focused on.
And, you know, I've always thought that, and I, you know, obviously I agree with tuition-free public education. I think that should always be an option. And I think that there should be something like that for med school where then you give service. I have no problem with somebody having to pay back the government by working in clinics or whatever. I mean, there's no shortage of need. So if you would put people through medical school, then you would be able to have doctors in places that don't really have access to healthcare. So I just think there should be a service option at a minimum. I mean, obviously med school does cost money. It's not something that can be free, like public, you know, tuition free college, but for sure you should be able to pay it back with service.
Yeah. And I think even when we just see how, what happened to, you know, public service workers who did not receive the money that was owed to them, after they did their time, they did not receive debt relief. I think that just scares a lot of people too. It's like, what will happen? And so how do you make sure that the policy that's set is not something that could change? You know, that it's just foundation.
It has to happen on so many fronts at the same time.
Yeah.
It's very intersectional. So at the same time that you're wanting to, you know, give people educational opportunities, we also need to be paying off other people's debt. Like it all has to kind of happen at the same time.
Yeah.
Ashmi, I think you are, Ashmi, I got it.
Ashmi.
Yeah, you got it.
You obviously are an exceptional candidate and you're doing it the right way. There's no question. You have to have a sound strategy. You have to be able to fundraise, and affability is obviously very important.
You're very affable is what he's saying to you.
We appreciate you coming on today, guys. It's Ashmi for Congress.
Ashmi.
Whatever.
We'll fight about this now for eternity.
Yeah. AshmiForCongress.com. Check her out. Give her a follow on all social media
platforms. If you are listening only, it is Ashmi with an A. Just saying.
Ashmi with an A.
I'm just saying, because if you are audio only, you could be confused.
Sign up to phone bank, text bank, be a small monthly contributor.
Definitely spread the wealth, guys. Yeah. Spread the love.
And if you are in the tri-state area,
volunteer.
Canvassing, especially before it gets really, really freezing. And then obviously things will not be as...
We'd love to have you back. We want to do panels by state. So like, we'd love to have you on and Isaiah and like, I'd love to
Melanie.
Yeah. Like we'd love to do state panels. Okay.
That'd be great. No, thank you so much for having me and for the work that you're doing. We need it. I think that's the thing is like, we now are building the infrastructure to mobilize. And yes, it's like, I still feel like it's very much nascent in American history, but it's going to take our generation to really make it happen. So thank you for doing the
work. Thank you for including me in your generation.
Thank you for your run. Yeah, running is so, I just say like as a candidate, when your name is on there, and when we started putting thousands of posters up around the district, and you see your face everywhere, you're like, this is so weird.
It's weird and it's awkward. Wait, when people start recognizing you and say that, it's very weird.
Wait until you get your first commercial on TV and people start talking.
Yeah, so we don't even, for New York, it's like, is it even worth it? You know, is it even worth it? Because how many people have TVs?
I don't know that their district it is. Our district is much older.
Yeah.
It's very different. We have a much older district than she does.
I would say that in your district, if it's a very walkable district where people are constantly...
Yeah. They don't need that. We do, unfortunately.
I don't have a car.
Yeah, you just need to have your signs everywhere.
Yeah.
And exactly. Most importantly, in small business storefronts.
Yes. Exactly.
If they're willing to put your sign up, that
small business.
A long way. Really does.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ashmi. We will have you back.
Thank you so much. Take care. Bye-bye.
She was lovely.
Yes. And again, I think we're getting good at the candidates we bring on. Really.
It's not hard.
No.
I'm sorry. It's not hard. All you have to do is you hear a candidate's name, you look them up, you know if they're non-corporate, you know if they're decent, you know what they stand for, and then you invite them on. It's not complicated. We're not taking adversarial, like we're not taking candidates that we wouldn't like.
And again,
we don't have to.
When they had the previous, primary, Nadler was up against, you know, several candidates. And the truth of the matter is, if you're going to unseat an incumbent like that, you really need to coalesce. Like, that's the way.
So you're saying they split. Well, there's this. And then I also would
That's what happened to Lauren Ashcraft, if you remember.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. There were two people. But I think that, you have to look at Lindsay's campaign, and Ashmi said this, like, that's what got them to where they are now. You build on it, and the more you keep it going. I would like to think that anything we have done has contributed to the furtherance of that, for whether it's us or someone else to be like able Sheila, to do that. Example. Yeah, I'd yeah. like
just
to
making
think
it more common and accepted.
I mean, Sheila was before us though, because she ran 18. But I mean, all of it, I think, is part of the process. I do. I think that the campaigns, and this is the biggest problem, I think, with Democrats, is they do not keep the momentum going, and they get very fixated on the person and not the mission. And this is what happened with all the Bernie nomads wandering aimlessly in Miami-Dade County that don't know what to do with themselves.
And you still hear, listen, there's still a lot of people who, you know, Tulsi Gabbard, for example, has attracted a whole new audience because of her shift. But at the same time,
I don't know how much she's really shifted versus how much we wanted to believe she was what we wanted to believe.
Oh, no, I think she's pretty much what she's always been.
That's what I think, too.
She's just pulled the veil off now.
Correct.
She's just
that's the thing. It's not a shift.
You know, she's a very socially conservative person. And that's a look. It's a byproduct of the family that she's from. It's a byproduct of being in the military.
And I don't really care about that either.
But at the end of the day, there are people who are still in denial that she's changed or that she isn't who she projected herself to be when they assumed.
Well, a lot are those people, any of the same people that think that still think of Obama as helpful and well, I thought he was going to be a lot more left than he turned out to be. And yet he's never changed. He's never been anything, but I just wasn't looking as closely at certain things.
We have a huge problem with cult of person. Yes. In society. And you know what? Before our next fantastic guest, Hector Azuguera, comes on, we do want to do our bootlicker of the week. And why are we doing this guy? We're doing this guy who is...
Because you're sitting there all cursing about Kyle Rittenhouse. So let's talk about it. Yeah. Let's talk about that douche. We're going to talk about that douche by recognizing this douche. Here we go. So
Anthony Sabatini is a state house representative here in Florida.
Because this is our Florida day.
But this is a guy who many of you may not know. Again, there were a number of representatives, including Coach Gozar, who was the one who did the meme about trying to kill AOC. Yeah, he decided to suggest that, you know, maybe we should build a shrine for Kyle.
Well, and Gates, of course, came out and said that he would give him a job.
Or so Madison Cawthorn.
That's great, Gates. Take him with you on your way to prison. Goodbye.
That all pales in comparison to Mr. Sabatini.
This guy.
So this is also the representative, mind you, that wanted to rename the Florida Turnpike the Donald Trump Highway. So, and he is a really, really incredible person. I totally love Mr. Sabatini. He totally gets it. He's a great guy.
I was decided. I didn't want to give you know, the Trumpist like any sort of FaceTime on this. So that's why I put the elephant there instead of licking Trump.
That, he is licking that butt all right. But at the end of the day, it's like, how much virtue signaling and hero worship can you possibly do in trying to be controversial?
Well, right. For the audio listeners, the story is Florida legislator calls for the creation of Kyle Rittenhouse Day following the not guilty verdict. While those of us with any brains are sitting here thinking, yeah, he got away with murder. There's this person who thinks we should be having a national holiday for him. This is how we end up with a skewed sense of history. This is how we end up not knowing what really happens 100 years from now.
And this will be a great topic to discuss with Hector, because what people still are not grasping is the fact that when Mr. Sabatini makes statements like this, it emboldens the craziest of the crazy to think, yeah, let's have Kyle Rittenhouse there.
And the next thing you know,
of Kyle Rittenhouse Day, we'll do what he did. It's like, my God.
No, this.
The illogic of it all is amazing.
Tony, you're such a douche.
Little Tony. I think
he's little. He's little.
Yeah, you can tell. Hey, little in a lot of
wonder
ways.
If he's friends with little Marco. Peas in a pod.
Peas in a pod. So without further ado.
Pigs in a poke.
We are going to bring in a fellow attorney and former BNC slate mate. With brand new Congress.
I love how you say fellow attorney like you were an attorney.
Oh, no, I'm talking about you. With him. You know, I'm just the outside.
I generally don't ever say that I'm an attorney. I generally like to be under the radar.
Okay, so two people we would like to chain to the bottom of the ocean are now.
That's what I'm saying. Like, why not just?
Yeah, you know,
put crosshairs on my forehead.
Fair enough. From my home state of New Jersey, he ran for the U.S. Congress in District, I want to say 8. I hope I'm getting it.
Yeah, he says yes.
Okay, I got it right. For North Jersey, that desperately needs a lot of change. And of course, he is bringing it as is Jen. So we welcome for the first time and definitely not the last time.
Is this his first time on? No. Is it your first time on here?
Yep. Long time viewer, first time joiner.
He's calling in today. Just wants to let everybody know.
He has such a good radio voice. But I know, you and I have been on panel at this, like panels.
Quite
together.
A few. Yeah.
Okay.
Quite a
few. That's why I'm sorry. I'm old. I just know that I've seen his face on the screen. How's it going?
It's going well. You know, the fight goes on in New Jersey. We just had, as you know, gubernatorial elections here in New Jersey. So I was working on municipal elections in Jersey City, which is the second largest city in New Jersey. And, you know, doing a lot of what you're talking about, trying to spark some progressive change at the electoral level. So it's been a lot of work and it's been a lot of fun, but still here, still fighting. And yeah.
So you're not currently running, though.
No, I'm not currently running, but I've been supporting a lot of other candidates who have been running for city council elections and other things like that at the local level. I think that that's been a really good outlet for me ever since the congressional race, which, you know, obviously I wasn't elected, but it definitely helped to spur a lot of change locally and started to get people involved who wanted to see the same sort of change that I was trying to fight for.
Right. I see it the same way, very much so, that if you just keep it going, you keep the momentum going and you keep building on it. And when people generally don't win, it's not that they necessarily go away, but they don't keep that same platform and that same momentum going. So, you know, yeah, you can be contributing in other ways, but if that all disperses, it's important to keep it going.
Yeah.
So one of the things we always do talk about regarding, never mind. You're Jersey. I'm sorry. I was going to talk like, I need to stop. I keep thinking we're with New York people.
You know, one thing that I think we should talk about is the fact that everybody got so fixated on Youngkin winning in Virginia. And the fact of the matter is, Governor Murphy won in New Jersey because he really made a conscious effort to move to the left. And he did. And whether it was with the minimum wage, the environmental movement is very pleased with the steps that he's been taking in terms of, you know, the different types of green infrastructure. In a state that has a lot of problems, New Jersey earns its reputation just like Florida does. I would like to think that Murphy, who became the first Democrat governor reelected in over 40 years.
Yep.
So the fact that there is clearly a red wave happening, it is painfully clear that that's what's happening. And we don't want to give all the credit to Bernie. I was at the rally at Rutgers, but I will say that Governor Murphy is definitely bucking the trend. And it's not surprising, as I'm sure you would agree, that corporate media and a lot of the Democratic establishment is not talking about it because it goes against the narrative of where they want the party to remain. And he's changing it in certainly for the better.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's really what I would have said, is that the reason that they don't want to talk about this story is because it completely destroys the narrative that the reason that Republicans had a good day or that Youngkin won is because the Democrats went too far left. You know, you have Terry McAuliffe in Virginia, who ran as the moderate's moderate, you know, the most moderate he could be. And then you had Phil Murphy, who did do affirmative things for the progressive side of the base. He did licenses for undocumented individuals. He's done a lot of reforms on environmental justice. He's done a lot to really pitch to a progressive base. He had a rally with Bernie Sanders while he was running for re-election. So I think that it's not a coincidence that if you give the base something to vote for, they will turn up for you. And I think that that's what you saw in New Jersey, as opposed to Virginia, that the progressives said in New Jersey, you know, I have a reason to show up and vote, whereas they did not in Virginia. And look what you got. Governor Murphy was reelected and Terry McAuliffe lost. So I think that there are a lot of important lessons there.
My bad.
I was just going to say, so are you, like, you're doing campaigns, but I know you also probably work on whatever issues that you have locally. And I know that you're very involved locally in what's going on there. Do you notice that there's been a change? I mean, our other friend in New Jersey was Zena.
Yes.
Yep.
And I know that Zena Spizakis. And I also know that the way that your system is set up is incredibly like, was it that it's uber filthy, uber weird, like the way your voting works, the way your ballots work, the way your name gets on the ballot, like all this stuff is extremely, I think, suppressive.
Yeah. Well,
that's a great segue.
Doesn't New Jersey have like a whole bunch of weird stuff like that?
Well, another friend
like of the show. Like with the ballot, name.
Another friend of the show, Imani Oakley, who was on in the 10th Congressional District. And the thing that she is really campaigning hard on is the fact that New Jersey has probably the most corrupt ballot.
That's what I'm saying.
If you can educate the audience as to exactly why it is so screwed up.
Because this is something people have no idea even exists. Like, I never heard of that. And I'm in Florida.
Well, when your state is essentially run by Frank Pallone.
Well, that's the thing. It's basically like you have like a congressionally mafia run state.
Yes, we definitely do. I would not disagree at all. And going up against the establishment in New Jersey in a lot of ways, I would, you know, liken to going up against the mafia, right? Because they make the rules and then they can break the rules to keep you from winning, but you know they're always holding you to this different standard. So let's talk about our ballot design, which is called the line. It's essentially called the line, which what it does is that it puts candidates in a column together, which creates an association between the voters, and it goes all the way up and down the ballot. So you'll have Joe Biden at president balloted with a hyper local official, like at the county level, right? So that county level official is basically riding the coattails of Joe Biden or whatever the incumbent is. And so if you're not on the line, you're kicked to like the other end of the ballot where many voters don't even look when they vote for you. So very visually, it creates this psychological game where basically people who get the line automatically get 35 to 50% of the vote. So literally just being placed on the line could determine and it often does determine who will win the election. You could literally put Santa Claus on the line and they would win that election because many voters just go down the line and they'll vote for every single person on that column.
Right. Yeah, that's incredibly skewed. And obviously that would be something that would be very hard to change because the people that have created that law like it there for a reason. So I don't know anything about your state legislature and like what that looks like. Like we're so red. Like anything having to do with electoral politics here, it's just there's no point in even having a Democratic say so. But I know New Jersey's pretty blue.
New Jersey is an entirely blue state. So that's the that's sort of the other thing is that I live in a one party state. Like there is no other option. Like even being a Republican is basically like being a third party candidate in New Jersey. And especially where I live in Hudson County, there is not a single elected Republican. Every single person in power is a Democrat. And it's basically the DNC at a local level. That's basically what we're up against. And you have every single county having their own version of the DNC, which basically rigs the election in favor of the establishment candidates.
That's interesting because that's like the exact opposite of Florida, right? Like, so you have this complete like domination of the Democrats, like a mafia in every county. Our county Democrats haven't made quorum in 5 years.
Wow.
And so they're incredibly weak in terms of any sort of infrastructure or any sort of actual power. But yet they act like this. It's the same thing. It's the same exact. It's really interesting. So regardless of whether they're in charge or not, they're still doing the same nonsense.
It's deliberate.
Yeah.
It is deliberate.
Yeah.
And so that's, again, the whole divide and conquer strategy is something that is utilized with this illusion that it really matters if you're red or blue in most cases, especially in one party dominated states. It doesn't matter because just as it's bad in New Jersey, it's just as bad, if not worse, in California and Illinois and, you know, some of the other. I mean, there's not a lot of them, but, you know, the completely blue dominated states face very similar problems. And I think that there is sort of this great awakening that we're experiencing right now. I think a lot of people are just aware that the system doesn't work and it isn't a question of whether you elect, you know, one person from one party. I think it does. What we always say is that it just matters whether you're elected on corporate special interest money or you're not. I mean, that really is the defining issue. And no greater example in New Jersey than, you know, if you ask me, if you were to line up the worst representatives in the United States, you'd be hard pressed for me to, you know, to pick somebody who's worse than Bob Menendez. I mean, it just doesn't get worse than that. And again, it, you know, he's as true blue Dem as it gets. So it really just comes down to whether you're part of the machine or you're not. Unfortunately, in New Jersey, you know, machine politics is a very big problem, maybe the worst in the country.
Absolutely. I live under a like 1890s Tammany Hall political system. Like that's literally what we live under. And I think the Bob Menendez example is a really good one. I would throw Josh Gottheimer in as one of my favorites as well.
He's not a Democrat.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Machine politics is non-ideological. Their ideology is whatever brings them money and power. That's the only thing that they care about. They don't have policies. They'll switch policies on a dime, depending on where the dollars send them, right? And so that's what you have is a system where it really doesn't matter whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, because you'll be doing the same thing no matter what. And so I think that that's where we have an opportunity, because we can say to people like, no, actually, look, we actually have a platform. We're giving you ideas. And that helps to bring a lot of people into this whole thing that, you know, nobody shows up to vote for a Josh Gottheimer based on their enthusiasm, right? They're sort of...
I don't know who it is, but I can imagine.
They have to be steered into it. This whole ballot system, like you're literally directed to who you have to vote for.
Yeah, it's cattle at a trough. It's you're really just corralling people. And for the most part, the people that participate and vote do tend to be older, and they do tend to be more establishment. And always our biggest problem is turnout. Right. And when younger people and more diverse people vote, it changes. But a lot of those people are very defeatist because of the existing system that we're in right now, where they have never really felt like any say so.
Exactly. Well, that's what I would say is that I think a lot of people of color and a lot of young people, they just don't have any buy-in for the system. So they'd rather walk away from it. And that's why I do a lot of work of like saying, you know, no matter how much you don't vote, somebody will be elected. Somebody's going to be put into this position. And would you rather have a say in that or not have a say in that? You know, because, you know, I turning back to the local in Jersey City, we had somebody run against the machine, a first-time candidate. His name was Frank Gilmore, and he won by an astounding margin. In the municipal elections, if nobody gets over 50%, it goes to a runoff. And he was in a three-person race, making it very, very difficult to get the 50%. But he got it. He got the over 50%, so he was elected outright. In a different ward, who we would call the progressive champion in downtown Jersey City, he won by an astounding margin, 2-1 against his opponent. So it shows that if you get the young people involved, if you give them buy into the system, if you show them, you know, no matter what you do, somebody will win this election and somebody will be elected. I think that that's a good way of bringing new energy and new people into the system.
Very interesting. The thing about Gottheimer is, if a lot of people don't know, if you don't know his slogan, it's personal freedom and lower taxes. That's a Republican. Just saying. but again, Gottheimer is the congressional representative, along with, I think, one of the representatives in San Diego, if I remember correctly. Gottheimer is responsible for the salt tax. That is the guy.
He loves the salt tax.
Well, of course. I mean, listen, he represents North Jersey in the wealthy suburbs where, as I like to point out, what middle class living in North Jersey is the equivalent of upper class living in almost every other part of the United States. So he is just kowtowing to people with money.
Who are the people that vote? That's the problem. We have that here. The old, wealthier people vote at much higher proportion than younger, poorer people. That's just how, for a myriad of reasons, right?
There's that word.
You love it. It's a lot of it is on the end of the establishment suppressing. A lot of it is on defeatism. A lot of it, I mean, there's various reasons, but we know there's no shortage of suppression. We know that, you know, when you go into a Black community and there's like one voting machine for every however many people, but it's scarce compared to when you go into the wealthy white neighborhoods where nobody has to wait in line to vote.
Yeah, literally no voting in the example I was just talking about, Frank Gilmore, who was running in one of the more predominantly Black wards of Jersey City, had literally zero voting locations.
Yeah. How does that work?
you know, you only have so many per city is what they say.
Right. But there needs to be some in every district.
Absolutely.
I that never occurred to me that you could actually not have a voting access within your own district.
Kind of like.
How is that possible?
Kind of like the areas during the presidential primaries where it just so happened that the areas where Bernie was going to do well, they had to either close the location, they didn't have enough people working.
Or the best is they relocate them and don't leave a sign so that you don't find it and you give up and go home. That's the kind of nonsense.
We have amazing group of volunteers that helped out on Jen's campaign and have stayed with us. And when the presidential race was going on, we had a handful of volunteers actually go up to Iowa, and they were reporting back to us all the dirty little tricks that the establishment was pulling, including moving a polling station like 40 minutes away from where it was supposed to be. Again, they can't win without cheating. And so when people on the Democratic side like to shout from the rooftops that, the Republicans are cheating, I'm like, yeah, they are. And but they so are you.
And they don't have superdelegates. There's that. The Republican process is infinitely more democratic. I'm sorry, but it is. They didn't want to pick Trump.
So then I guess being in the shadow of New York City, Hector, from your perspective, we obviously
that's a little
about,
demeaning.
Well,
and honestly, I'd agree with it in a lot of ways.
I think we don't get the armpit of New Jersey. We're the flaccid penis.
Oh my god!
Yeah, I'd rather be the armpit than the
flaccid penis.
So
yeah.
That's what it is. But one of the things that we talk about, aside from corporate special interest money being the defining issue of our time, is the influence that, unfortunately, corporate media still has over a lot of the electorate, especially the older electorate. And if you could talk about what that's like, because as we like to say, when we're talking to people locally or wherever, you always know if you're talking to somebody who's watching MSNBC, CNN, or Fox News. It's pretty clear when you talk to them that they're basically drones repeating.
Because people don't understand issues. They just know talking points.
Absolutely. And like, I will tell you that I live in like the corporate media hellscape, where I'm doing text banking for local candidates, literally municipal level candidates. And the text backs that I get are like, let's go Brandon, right? And I'm like, you know, I appreciate the sentiment, but I'm not talking about the presidential race and nobody's running for president. You know, I don't think Donald Trump or Joe Biden is running for president, is running for city council in Jersey City. So, you know, why, you know, it hurts. It really does hurt, because often you're trying to get a reaction out of this person. You're trying to understand, you know, what are the issues that matter to you? What can we talk about? What direction would you like to see our society go in? And when all you get is like MSNBC and like Fox talking points, it makes it really frustrating and really difficult. And I think that we do have a lot of work to do. That's why I think shows like yours are really important. And, you know, it's important to give people another outlet to get information where they're not just going to be fed the same talking points over and over, because, it really stifles the window within which we can have conversations, when literally you talk to some of these people and you tell them a fact about the world, and you have that it does not compute moment that it's like, well, I can't add this to my knowledge of the world because it breaks the way I understand things. And
it's cognitive dissonance.
Yeah. And you come up against that wall. And, you know, I know people who are Latinos, Black men who support Trump, who are eating up the anti-vax stuff, who are eating up all sorts of misinformation. And we need to combat that stuff, because it's all happening within a larger context. And if we lose those people, you lose the ability to sell them on a vision that is much more hopeful and much more positive than whatever they're thinking about. You know, a conversation I was having with somebody not that long ago was the JFK Jr. comes back to life and Donald Trump gets elevated to Jesus level or something like that. Jen clearly has not heard this story yet.
No, I haven't, but I'm all about JFK Jr. coming back. Like, that would be good. That was some nice looking.
There's some nice concern.
That is some serious man candy there.
Point being is that it's really not that hard to sell somebody on a vision of the world that's much more based in reality and hopeful than expecting JFK Jr. to come back from the dead and to assume the presidency. But we have to get into those spaces and talk to those people.
I agree. And that's one of the reasons that I always say I'll talk to anybody. I'll go on any platform or any, you know, my message is my message. It doesn't matter who I'm saying it to. So, but the amount of crap you get from people on the left for who you go on whose show and you had this person on your show and, well, they said this about so-and-so and they support this. And it's like, you're not going to reach a broad enough group of people when you keep acting that way.
Yeah.
I think, you know, politics is about addition, not division. And if you're not bringing more people under your 10, you're really just not doing this right. You know, at the end of the day, you can agree, you can disagree, but you should be adding more people to this 10, especially if we're, you know, fighting for a democratic society where you have to build consensus with others to get decisions made. So, you know, I know that there's a lot of infighting that goes in on the left. I know that there's a lot of frustrating stuff. I try to ignore as much of that as possible and focus on people who are doing really beautiful and positive things, because, you know, you really can sort of go into a rabbit hole of like who's being a bad actor on the left. And there's definitely a lot of that going along these days. But I think there's enough. There's also much, much more positive that we can focus on and put our energy into, because at the end of the day, you have choices. You only have but so many hours in a day. And you know, what you spend your time on it is going to consume what you do. So I really try to highlight the beautiful and the positive in the left and try to leave the silly stuff to the side, because those people are really not doing anything important.
I think it's
very true.
I think it's very important that because there's a lot of division right now, especially surrounding the results of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. Again, you can have your opinion about him, but I think it really comes down to, as attorneys, as you can speak to, the prosecution did not handle that case well. And on top of that, I think it's incredibly important right now to focus on the fact that you could believe whatever you want about Kyle Rittenhouse, but aside from probably proving reckless endangerment, they did not prove their case. And this is immensely vital right now because of the Ahmaud Arbery case that's going on, and why that case to me is infinitely more important than the Rittenhouse case, that those good old boys in the Deep South, who, if you've been paying attention to the case, they should absolutely be convicted of first degree murder. But it's a question of, you know, understanding the law and understanding that it doesn't always work the way you want it to, but it can if it's done the right way. And that to me is of great concern, because very often when corporate media puts their thumb on a particular case, I think it creates undue pressure on the state, the attorney's office, to make the case. What are your guys' thoughts on?
They have pressure to make the case in the first place. But yeah, I mean, public pressure is definitely an issue. I'm sad to say that I wasn't really following. I wasn't. And I know that the law there is very specific, and what he did technically, I guess, could qualify as self-defense. The other gentleman pulled out a gun first. I mean, again, I'm not an expert on Wisconsin law. But it doesn't seem that they went as far enough with what they had as they could have. So that's just my gut, but I really wasn't following, and I feel bad saying that, but I wasn't.
I did watch a good amount of the trial, and honestly, just day to day, you really could tell that the prosecution was not having a good time and was not really making a good case. I think a lot of people kind of put a lot on like being a lawyer or like having this sort of like magical power, and like that does not exist. Like, what I wish I could give to people is like, lawyers are not special people and they don't know anything that you don't know. Like, if you just watch the interactions between the judge and the lawyers, you could see that the prosecution was not making a good case. Just as like, I'm not disinterested. Obviously, I thought that Rittenhouse was guilty and that he should have been found guilty. But even I found myself saying like, wow, the prosecution's not really doing a good job proving their case. And I see a night and day happening with the Ahmaud Arbery case, which is a good thing. You know, that prosecutor seems to be much more on the ball, and she seems to be making a much better case. And so I do expect something different to happen there. But I think that any person could see that the prosecution in Rittenhouse's case just really wasn't clicking, wasn't making a good case. They weren't very effective. And, you know, I think any lay person who was watching could have seen that.
So they obviously weren't very motivated, and I'm sure there is a lot of reasons we could assume that they weren't very motivated. And I've also put a lot of thought into the fact that how would this have been if that were a black man?
Yeah.
How would that have gone? And I think everybody needs to be thinking about that, whether they could make their case on, you know, murder or not. That's neither here nor there. Their lack of interest in pursuing it. The fact that they're just not very motivated to actually prosecute this individual is what is made apparent. And the fact that he was even out on bail, that was something that he was able to do, is something that isn't normally going to be afforded to somebody with less means. And the whole thing is just a travesty. That's 100%. What I mean. It just.
Yeah. And listen, we talk about if it was a black man, like I give people this example. Exactly. Imagine a 17-year-old black kid from New York City took an AK-47 to the Capitol on January 6th and killed two Trump supporters. Would that kid have made it to trial? No. Would he have survived 24 hours? Nobody in America could say that person would have lived to see trial. And so to try to deny the, you know, I was in a lot of different conversations as the decision was coming down. And there were people, again, who supported Kyle Rittenhouse saying, well, you know, how could this have anything to do with racial justice? He killed two white guys, you know? And they're ignoring the entire context of this happening in the wake of a police shooting of a black man, that he was there, obviously, on the other side of that. You know, I think that it's really clear that there were racial components to this, despite the fact that, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse is a white person and that his victims were white. That does not erase the context within this, which these murders happened, which was a racial justice protest on which Kyle Rittenhouse is clearly on the other side of that fight.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the idea that somebody purposefully went out of their way to arm themselves and travel to another state to get involved in something shows an intent. And that's not something that most people would just think to do. I'm going to arm myself and go to another state. He was wanting to find somebody to shoot. You don't go somewhere with a gun if you're not wanting to find somebody. It's like, if all you have is a hammer, all you're going to see are nails. So you don't arm yourself and go somewhere and not be looking for trouble. So to act like somehow you're a victim is crazy to me.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even necessarily say that he may have been looking to shoot somebody, but when you're so obsessed with, like, we talk about gun culture in America, and obviously you live in Jersey City. So, you know, there are many issues that exist, not just in the inner cities, but also in the rural parts of the country where people are just obsessed with, you know, guns, and they have these grandeur fantasies about, oh, well, I'm going to be a hero and I'm going to do this, that, and the other thing. And it's like, it isn't what you think it is, because when it actually does happen, you know, he may have thought that he was going to end up being this big hero. He's lucky he didn't get himself.
Think of people like him, like I think of like the people that you would see as incels on Law and Order that end up sitting there and gaming and then getting out there and trying to help and have no real ability to interact with people on a personal level, don't have personal relationships. And I do attribute a lot of this to the culture that we live in, where we have so much less personal interaction and everything is texting and everything is gaming. And I'm not blaming video games for making him to go shoot people. That's not what I'm saying. But we're talking about people that have very limited social skills and real life experience. And I think that does sort of warp your perception of the universe.
I absolutely 100% agree. Like this is definitely a kid who played way too much Call of Duty and thought that he could really do it. And when it happens in reality, it's not anything like the video game. And he had to face that reality. And he's lucky that he's not going to jail for the rest of his life. But there is an entire culture of these sorts of individuals that see themselves as like the saviors of society. And they're just like one incident away from killing a whole bunch of innocent people. And I do think that this is something that we have to be aware of and be careful with, because a whole generation of like unhappy, you know, men with nothing but time and guns on their hands, that's not a good thing at all.
Exactly. And I do think it's something that people who are happy and satisfied and in normal relationships, be them platonic or otherwise, don't are not as prone to go out and do that. And the reality is, it is men. It is men. I haven't seen a 17-year-old girl strap on an automatic weapon and go and start shooting. I haven't seen it.
Not a single one. It is.
And it isn't that there aren't crazy women. There's definitely crazy women.
but they, like, seem to not kill a whole bunch of people at one instant for some reason.
It's not outwardly violent. We're much more passive aggressive. But I would say like it is a male problem. I hate to say that, but it is. This is definitely a man problem because we do not see women doing these things.
No, and I do agree with that 100%.
Yeah, and I think, unfortunately, this is a reflection of our broken system and the fact that people are getting so desperate and stories like this may become even more commonplace. And, you know, the fact that the current administration is thumbing us in the eye, just the reconciliation bill being watered down to almost nothing. I mean, the only thing that's really stuck around that is of value is the, you know, universal pre-K. But, you know, and I don't want to take anything away from the fact that Medicare is expanding to hearing. Hearing is very important, but hearing is not vision and it is not dental. The two much more vital components of Medicare expansion that we should have. That's just one example of how bad things are and the way that society has just been bred to believe that, well, we're really not entitled to this. You know, we're not entitled to live a decent life. And I think the more you squeeze people this tight, it doesn't matter if Donald Trump is in office. It doesn't matter if Joe Biden's there. It just matters that people are getting desperate and they're not going to take it anymore.
And we also lack mental health services. So you get desperate people with lack of mental health services and a huge amount of guns.
Maybe the most underrated part of universal health care.
Lack of mental health services.
Mental health. And that, of course, is, and again, you know, a doped up society on everything Big Pharma can throw at you.
I just think everybody should, I would just be giving cannabis to everybody. Because if you're not going to give them mental health stuff, you should at least be giving them cannabis.
Right. No, I agree. We have so many issues coming up with the Build Back Better. You know, they're trying so hard. And it kind of ties back to our conversation earlier about why people are abandoning the Democratic Party. And it's because they're not seeing material changes. You know, they see the attempt to throw crumbs at people, and you're not going to get a lot of credit for that. You're really only going to get credit for real results. And if the Democrats want to avoid a bloodbath in the near future, you know, they really got to show out for people, and they got to bring some results to the table, because what has been given so far is not anywhere near enough, and it's not going to get them anywhere good in the near future. So we're looking for change.
I think it's at this point, to me, when I look at the Democrats, and by the way, when I say Democrats, I'm talking like big D centrist establishment Democrats, corporate special interest Democrats. They don't want to win. Like, I don't think it's that they don't know better. We talk all the time. He's like, why are they so stupid? I'm like, they're not stupid. They're brilliant. It works exactly how they want it to work. I don't think it's remotely in question.
How are people still not hip to this, to the game of the rotating villain? How do they not?
It's like WWF to me.
Right.
That's how old I am, as I still say WWF.
And I do the same thing. I still call it WWF. But
that's what it's like.
Yeah,
red versus blue. It's tribalism, and it there's no point to it. There's no there.
Well, there is a point in that they distract people and they create this sort of culture of division that you see the other side as so evil that you'll never work with them, and it just flips over and over and over again.
No, I just mean they have no substance to their parties, either of them. Like, it's not like they really stand for anything. It's not like what they're actually supposedly fighting about is real. You know, watching people like Manchin and Sinema and then the other side fighting back, that's all just a theater.
Yeah.
It is. Like, that's not real. They don't, first of all, if you understand MMT, it's all ridiculous anyway that they're sitting there and nickel and diming this thing. But they don't, people like Nancy Pelosi don't want to win.
No.
They don't want to win. I mean,
they want a strong Republican Party.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I honestly, when she said that, it's like, God, the game is up. Don't you get it?
They fundraised the best. When they had Trump, was one of the best things to ever happen to someone like Nancy Pelosi. Yeah. They love that. They love having a villain. They fundraise like crazy. They don't have to actually do anything. They can blame everything on them. And it's just, it's bizarre to me that people don't see this.
But that's, of course, our task going forward, is to continue to uplift candidates like an Imani Oakley, like Harizi.
We just had Ashmi.
Chef running in New York's 10th. There are good people that are out there making the change. We on the non-corporate left need to do a much better job of coalition building and strategy.
Hell yeah. That's
definitely our two weakest things by far.
We get very emotional.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that that is one of the things where why the Republicans win more.
We are, listen,
I do.
We are very friendly with Andrew Yang, and he was on our podcast recently, and he said, look, they can agree with me on 20 issues, but if the 21st is incorrect, that's it for me. And he's right. And that's a big problem.
And the right isn't like that.
And I like to say, you know,
the right takes what they get. Like they fall in line and they really understand what the bigger picture more so. Like Democrats are just they're it's too emotional. It's too personal. They care more about their feelings. They have to like somebody. Like, I don't really have to like somebody. I've said it before. My understanding is that Bernie is a cranky old man. Probably wouldn't like him. Wouldn't necessarily want to hang out with him. I really don't know. Don't care. Right. Like that's not the point. Like, I don't need to be friends.
Yeah.
Right.
And that, of course, is where the change needs to happen. We have to recognize that you're not going to get anything and everything every time. What you can get, however, is knowing that the most important aspect of this whole movement for a better future has to do with whether or not you are bought and paid for by corporate.
That's really the barometer.
That's it. If, you know, you can, perfect example, there are a lot of people who can't stand Rand Paul. They can't stand Mike Lee, two very libertarian conservative senators. But you know what? They're not bought and paid for by the military-industrial complex.
It makes a difference.
So when they stand up in Congress, and of course, no one talks about it because why would they? They are saying, we do not want to give another nearly $1 trillion or 500 billion, I think is the number, in arms sales to the Saudis. And no one's talking about it. But of course, who's standing up with them? Who is standing up with them?
Bernie.
That's what matters.
Well, this is why I find it hard to hate on Rand Paul. Like, I mean, I definitely have issues with him. But I think that he's not a corporate whore. And so I appreciate that. And comparing to how low the bar is in Congress, like we don't have a lot of good options.
There are only two senators, Capitol Hill, that lobbyists do not meet with, Rand Paul and Bernie Sanders.
So I respect it. I can't help it.
So unfortunately, the whole system is the problem. And we have to recognize that that's how we're going to make this change. It's going to take time. But the sooner we recognize that that is the issue, that that is what we need to do. I mean, to me, that is our future, and we're obviously very appreciative.
That's what we try to do here.
We're very appreciative that you came on today. And in the meantime, if there's anything you're working on, Hector, anything you want to plug, you know, please fire away.
Yeah.
No, I mean, just touching base off that, I think that you're right. I think the left and right thing, it's starting to wear away a lot more. And the real difference is whether you're corporate backed or not. And, you know, the left and right thing, I think that there are some good people who are conservative minded. You know, you don't have to agree with me on every issue. If you see the establishment as the problem and you're willing to build a more socially equitable world, like, I think that we can work together, whether that's like defunding the military-industrial complex, fighting against big pharma. And I think that there are a whole host of issues that we can find some solidarity with people on. Currently, I'm still working on municipal races in Jersey City. We have a runoff that we're working on currently. Our candidate, Kevin Bing, is in a runoff this upcoming December 7th against an All Lives Matter 5G causes cancer candidate. That is our Democratic incumbent in Ward C of Jersey City. So
the QAnon shaman type guy is who you're talking about, and that's the Democrat.
Well, hey, listen, the
Democratic incumbent donated to a Trump candidate in Pennsylvania. Like I already said, 5G causes cancer. There's a couple. All Lives Matter.
That one I'm not so sure. I don't agree with.
He's a Joe.
I'm not going to get negative about the 5G causes cancer.
He's a Joe Manchin Democrat. He basically is a Democrat and supports Donald Trump. So there you go.
Yeah,
and
so
I think he's a really Hector. Introduce him to me. He's a really great guy, tremendous person, and I support him 100%, 110%, and invite him to my golf course. We'll have a great time.
Nobody wants to golf with you.
So please look into Kevin Bing. He's a great candidate, and
website?
Is there a website?
look up Kevin Bing in Jersey City. I don't know the website off the top of my head.
There's one Kevin Bing running in Jersey City, guys.
I guarantee.
Look up Kevin Bing.
Yeah. And yeah, other than that, you know, I'm staying in the fight. We're fighting to abolish ICE in New Jersey. I'm still in the middle of a lawsuit about that. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on, but, you know, I'm sure I'll get another opportunity to talk about it as things heat up. And, you know, I really just appreciate you having me on and giving me the opportunity to talk to you guys about this stuff.
Sure. No, I dig you. I'm surprised. I'm sad that I didn't have you on before. I thought that I had, again, I don't know.
I'll take that as a repeat, invitation.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Thanks for coming on, Hector.
Hector, thank you so much, my friend. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Love y'all.
Bye. He's so sweet. That's why I thought he had been on before, because I've been on several panels with him. And so, you know, to me, it's like I'm talking to people.
We're building, like you said, if you're ever going to consider running again, you got to have this really strong coalition of people. And listen, at the end of the day, name recognition and the coalition you build is very important.
He reminds me of Anthony.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, I can see that.
And just in how he's involved, like with the locals. I don't know. Yeah. He just reminded me of his very, very calm demeanor.
Well,
very,
that again is another one of the problems. That
Anthony
we have
is
here
very
in
soothing.
Yeah, in Florida, we do not have this consistency of people who are fighting the power, if you will.
No, and if he can abolish ICE up there, I hope he'll come down and do it here.
Yeah, that's not going to be easy in a state like Florida.
They need to go away.
Yeah.
ICE needs to go away.
Well, there's no point to ICE. I really wish people would understand
they
that.
They don't understand it. We had it under control,
yeah,
people.
We already have a way of dealing with, you know, illegal immigration. ICE is government overreach. People.
It's basically it's the SS.
Yeah.
I think of them like the Gestapo.
It is the Gestapo.
I do. I think of them like that. And it is. It's outside of the purview of what we need. It's totally government overreach and it's very authoritarian.
Not only that, but they violate people's constitutional rights.
Right.
And we're not talking about necessarily the people who are illegal. We're talking about the people who end up getting involved in these sting operations that ICE does.
I just think that it's evil. What it really does is it truly criminalizes. And I know this sounds weird, but to me, illegal immigration is a civil thing.
Yeah.
It is. I'm sorry. Could you be fined if you haven't done your right paperwork? Yeah, whatever. Okay. But what ICE does is it really criminalizes people that aren't criminals. Now, when there is somebody who's here illegally and is a criminal, there's something we have for that. It's called the police department and the state attorney's office. That is what it is. We don't need ICE for that. That's the beauty. We don't need them. They're completely superfluous.
So before we go today, as you guys know, we obviously have our focus on Florida.
We have some interesting things.
A lot of important stuff.
Check him out. He's holding it.
Let's
go the other direction.
Because as it relates to the conversation that we're having now, and especially the problems that we have here in Florida, you know, I am one of those people who thinks that a lot of the whole racism talk is very overblown. A lot of it is used for political talking points and gotchas and whatnot. I look at the systemic issue. I look at where it really does matter. And so one of the things that has happened over the past, I don't know, it's probably been maybe two or three decades, but the Aryan Nation and other white supremacist groups have infiltrated our criminal justice system.
Well, I mean, certainly on the corrections side.
Yes.
I wouldn't say our whole, yes, we definitely have issues in police departments. But yeah, the corrections, apparently officers have been completely infiltrated by white supremacist groups. Doesn't surprise me. And yet they seem to just be able to do that.
And in Dixie, Florida, it is obviously this is a state, I've told the story before. You know, when I lived in Delray, I went out one evening in Lake Worth and was just hanging out with some friends. And, you know, this is like this area not far from the ocean, but it's, you know, like a bar strip area and a whole bunch of places. And I was walking past this one place and these four, you know, white guys get out of their pickup truck, and one of the four guys didn't have a shirt on and he had a swastika tattooed right over his chest, right on his heart. And, you know, until you see that, you know, you don't really know what to expect in terms of, well, I guess it is real. And I guess people really do feel this way and they are actively, you know, they have so much hate you know, that's a big part.
So what this stems from is in June, three Florida prison guards who boasted of being white supremacists beat, pepper sprayed, and used a stun gun on an inmate who screamed, "I can't breathe," at a prison near the Alabama border, otherwise known as Floribama. According to a fellow inmate who reported to state, the next day, the officers at Jackson Correctional Institution did it again to another inmate. The report filed with the Florida Department of Corrections Office of Inspector General alleged. But here's the thing. Both of these incidents, not just were people of color that it happened to, both incidents occurred in view of cameras. That's the thing. Both happened in full view of cameras. Like, there has obviously been a system of we're just able to do that.
Sure.
And so I think that's just really disgusting.
And the fact that you have these pickup trucks with the Dixie flag wrapped in the Florida, outline is it's incredible that when you really want to focus on the real problem, that is a real problem, because again, there is this inhumane corrections that we have in the United States. Of course, it's for profit.
This is interesting.
And what's that?
This summer, one guard allowed members of a white supremacist inmate group to meet openly inside a Florida prison. Black officer happened upon the meeting and reported it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So it's apparently this is just flagrant.
It is. In an our state, a lot of things are flagrant. So that in itself is a big problem. So when we talk about, you know, the white supremacy issue, which exists, does it exist the way that corporate media blasts it on TV? No. But this is a problem. This is a real problem. And it's obviously, it puts a lot of people in danger.
And it also, there's a problem for officers who do report.
Yes.
Officers who want to blow the whistle on colleagues are often ostracized and labeled a snitch, according to current and former officers. Mark Caruso, a former sergeant with Florida Corrections, who was twice fired and reinstated after blowing the whistle on fellow guards. So two times he had to blow, on two different occasions, blow a whistle, was fired, and then had to fight to get his job back.
This is a white guy.
Yeah. And keeps reporting. So he worked at three prisons in Florida and reported inmate beatings and officer misconduct multiple times. He was fired after reporting on a colleague at the first prison where he worked as a sergeant.
And this is one of the
unbelievable.
Reasons, and this is one of the reasons why we talk constantly about the need for ending qualified immunity. Because when that happens, that's when you're going to be able to get rid of these types of bad apples. Because in the code of silence, when they talk about the blue line code of silence, most of that, while officers protect other officers, is true. They will not rat each other out if they know they're violating the law because of the fact that qualified immunity stands. If that were to be removed, and officers would literally be in a situation where they could lose their livelihoods because of the actions of bad apples, they're not going to stand for that. So that's where the change we really need to see. And so
this was one of the ones you picked. So I hope you know what you're saying about it.
This is not enough to talk about Florida, because certainly our problems just keep getting bigger and better every day. It looks like in conservative Southwest Florida, retirees are getting themselves back into the workforce. Ain't that lovely? So if you are in either Sarasota, Fort Myers, Naples. Hey, I guess it ain't working out for you. So, you know, what the hell's the point of retiring? How can you retire? You could be in your 70s and getting back into the workforce. That sounds wonderful, don't you think?
Yeah. So what's interesting is how this is always posed as a good thing, sort of like when W was like, oh, how wonderful that you could work three jobs. Only in America could you have three jobs. Only here would it be seen as a positive thing that a bunch of retirees have to go back to work. and we know why. They can't afford to live. They can't afford to live. Their medications aren't covered. Who knows? Their dental, their vision, their, you know, like, these are not people that should have to go back to work. But yet, and it's, of course, it's just, I put that picture with it. I mean, yes. It looked like it was fun.
Like, they really are looking forward to that.
They're loving it. Nobody wants to go back to work.
No.
You know, they're just not. And they're certainly not wanting to have the jobs that they're seeking, which are like very, very working jobs, you know, minimum wage jobs.
But let's be honest here. And this is one thing that isn't being talked about enough. There's a big difference between wanting to work and having to work. That is the problem here. This isn't a question of, I all of a sudden want to get back into the workforce.
Right, I'm bored. I haven't enjoyed retirement as much as I thought it would.
No, I can't afford to live, so now I have to get back to work.
Right.
So when we talk about things like Social Security expansion or universal basic income, that's why we talk about things like this, because cost of living is out of sight, out of mind, especially in South Florida. Whether you're on the East Coast, which is blue, or the West Coast, which is red, it is a huge problem. And this is proof.
We don't care about the old people. We only care about the old people when
they weed their vote.
We care about them. Sort of like veterans. We only care about certain groups of people when we can like bring them out for photo ops when it's time to vote, and we can pat them on the back and be like, we support you.
And now, of course, we have the ultimate Florida story. South Florida woman detained for attempting to smuggle 56 guns into Canada. I wonder why. 56 guns.
Well, and here's the thing that's interesting. It is. But what I go, and the fact is, she had to be from Florida, South Florida. I wonder if it was, what's his name's wife? Remember, she got caught with all those weapons in the car, the quarterback. Tannehill.
Oh, yeah.
Tannehill's wife. Yeah. She got caught with like a whole basic arsenal in the back of her car. But, you know, I remember from Michael Moore's movie, Bowling and Columbine, which for me was profound and life-changing. But anyway, that Canada has a lot of guns. Canada has no shortage of guns. They have plenty of guns in Canada. It isn't that we have so many more guns. Actually, in fact, at the time of that, there's a lot of guns in Canada. They are not without guns. They just don't feel the need to use them on people the way we do. That's all. They have lots of guns. So I don't know, you know, but yeah, I don't know how she thought that would work.
Well,
which of course she had to be from South Florida.
What is always so interesting is that
Vivian Richards, 48.
With an arsenal. With more guns than her age.
Oh, Vivian. In all fairness, who knows what she's been forced to do? Who knows what her stake is in this? She could just be seriously the patsy that did. Who knows? We don't know. She could have been someone who didn't even know was in the trunk of her car. We don't really know.
Well, judging by the photograph from the Associated Press, it looks to me like a lot of Glocks, so a lot of handguns. But again, you know, why do you feel the need to have so many weapons?
I don't understand.
It's like, let me tell you something. If we ever did have a civil war in the United States, the right is going to win very quickly.
If there's ever a civil war in the United States, I'm moving anywhere near where Bo lives in Florabama.
Yeah.
That's where I'm going. Like, I already have my
escape plan. Bunker.
Let me tell you something. If something happens, I'm getting my soon-to-be camper and heading to Florabama.
Bo with the Fifth Column. Jen and Bo.
I love him. I do. He's...
Last story before we go.
We have to take the banner off so you can fully see for people who are watching. So, Bald Eagle. And this happened... Wait. I think it was in... Was it in Destin? I think it was in Destin or...
It was Northern Florida.
Yeah. Bald Eagle swoops in and steals his shark. I think it's brilliant.
Because... You know, what else?
He was fishing.
Yeah,
no,
not a fish, but a shark.
Well, first of all, and I will say this in fairness to fisher people, that you can't always control what gets on the end of your line.
That's
okay.
True.
And oftentimes the sharks do get on the line, even though that's not what you're trying. The guy was probably trying to fish for like tarpon or whatever other game fish. Whatever. But anyway, he had a shark and then he did not have it for long. And look how proudly this eagle stands with it. He's got his fish. To him, it's a fish.
When we picked our national mascot, we really got it right with the bald eagle.
Oh, yeah.
It is such a majestic.
Aren't they awesome?
They really are.
And here's the thing that's so funny.
I've seen it like once or twice.
Okay, I've seen them a few times. But what you have to do is if you ever get an opportunity to hear them, you have no idea how ridiculous they sound. They sound like... Me. Like they sound like little chirpy caged birds. And then they have these their voices are completely disproportionate to what they look like. Like you think it would sound like that. No, it's a kee, 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 kee. They actually sound really annoying. When I was in Sanibel last night with Reese, there were a bunch of them flying overhead and we actually heard them and they should be embarrassed for themselves. But yeah, they have the most mealy, horrid little whiny voices. Oh no, they're brilliant. When we went fishing for salmon off of, Vancouver that time, they would be, you would watch them swoop down and take the fish. Like it was amazing. What we do have, And I see one every day, are osprey that live all around us. But most people don't notice them. You see them every day. You just have to look on the light post.
I'll tell you, a creature that is very interesting to observe when they do their kamikaze dive for fish in the water are pelicans. If you've never seen them do their
thing. I haven't seen the pelicans.
I've seen it.
I've seen the osprey.
Yeah. No, the pelicans I've seen. Pelicans are, well, they're on the west coast of Florida, but it is pretty amazing.
I think we have pelicans here.
I haven't seen them too much.
There's pelicans over at the pier, I think. Like, there's pelicans here.
But watching them just, like, go, like, literally like a kamikaze, like, right into the water to grab their fish.
This pleases you?
I think it's just amazing how they...
I like watching...
Watching nature in action is...
It is. I have a thing with raptors because when they... People don't realize they have very long legs. Owls have extremely long legs. People look it up. Look up owl legs. You will be people, and you will see the pictures. No, they've got long legs. People don't realize it, but if you look up owl legs, you will see pictures where people who have owls are holding their feathers up so you can actually see their legs. It's ridiculous. They have these long, skinny legs. But anyway, so raptors, when they're swooping in, they're flying feet first. Like, it's the coolest looking thing ever when an osprey is diving in because they're flying like this and they snatch it and they're just gone. Like, it's brilliant. It is. Yeah. I love the osprey.
So we really appreciate you all coming in today. We had a pretty consistent group for not too many big names, but we really appreciate you guys. Patreon.
They like us talking about the bird life in Florida.
So just so you know, we're very transparent about how we spend our money.
Yes. We just made a very good donation, people on our...
With your help, we contributed $200 to the new community garden being built at Hallandale High School. 85% of the students that go to the school are on free or reduced lunch. They come from very impoverished backgrounds. Now they're going to have an opportunity not only to have free organic fruits and vegetables, but they're going to learn gardening sustainability.
And you know who's involved in this project? No, none other than our friend Vern.
Vern Sibyl, one of the most amazing
and of course, and I'm not mentioning other names because I don't know the level of involvement of other people, but I do know that he was consulted in the very beginning of this project and brought over and went over to the high school and looked at the lot. So it will be at Hallandale High. Do we have the link for the flyer for people to donate? Like, what is that?
You have the link. I'll put it up right now.
Yeah, it's like tiny it's URL. Like,
no, it's like seed money.
But it's tiny URL, Hallandale Garden or whatever. Or no, that's the website. We need to put the link up, guys. We're going to forward the link. Did we put out an email with it?
We haven't put out the email yet, but if you guys want to check out our Instagram post from last night, we highly recommend that you check it out.
See, that's what it is. Yes, it's tinyurl.com/Hallandale Garden.
Tiny
URL. So guys, here's the deal with this. This is really cool.
What is it?
Hallandale. Remember Hallandale with an A-N-D-A-L-E. There's no E. Until the end, Hallandale Garden. Okay, guys, what's so really cool about this? So this project is going, there's a 30-day challenge. And if you guys can help out during this 30-day challenge, this is a really big thing that will help. So how this works is, in addition to keeping the funds they raise, they have a chance to win a grant of up to $1,000 based on how much we raise over this 30-day period. So
goal is $2,500. Right now they're at, with our contribution, I believe they're at just over 1,600.
So we need
not
some
that far away.
Yeah. So by December 15th, whichever of these groups raises the most money will get the additional $1,000. So guys, this would be really helpful. These kinds of projects are like so important. I like, it's so important because not just for these kids, but for all kids to learn sustainability is huge, but especially in communities where they don't have access to healthy food. They don't have access to produce. They have access to like the Quickie Mart, which is full of junk.
You said the Quickie Mart.
The Quickie Mart.
For somebody who doesn't really watch The Simpsons.
Well, I just, well, other, well, because the other thing I ever call them are Stop and Robs, well, because that's what my, they're called Stop and Robs. In my Con Crim Pro class.
So not Stop and Shop.
No, they're called Stop and Robs. Professor Schmaleski from Con Crim Pro. Professor Schmaleski from Con Crim Pro, when he would be talking, you know, talking law, talking case, talking whatever, he would always refer to it as a Stop and Rob. That was just the name he used. So guys, send some seed money. help the Hallandale Garden. We'll put it out again. I'd love to put this on our website. How do we have this put on our website? I also don't know how I can scan something that's a picture on my phone.
Send it. We're going to have an email sent out. We're going to get them over the top, make sure they get their goal, maybe even surpass their goal.
And it's important for me because I really need a garden to be in.
Yeah, this is a great thing. And of course, it's not going to be subject to gentrification.
No, it won't be subject to gentrification. Unfortunately, it will be subject to Broward County schools and that kind of stuff, but it will not be subject to gentrification.
I highly doubt it's going to be that big of a deal. I think we'll have a very...
It's going to be great, guys. What do we have coming up this week?
You guys can check out patreon.com/generational change. We really appreciate it.
When you donate to us, it goes to stuff like that. I've handed out 3 homeless packs this week.
So we are on Tuesday going to be at a gobble giveaway with State Senator Chevron Jones.
It's not called gobble giveaway.
That's what I call it.
Okay, anyway, it's a Thanksgiving distribution
on Tuesday
In West Park, right? West Park mm-hmm. with Chevron.
Yeah. So definitely a great event that we'll be a part of. And our Wednesday live stream is going to be Wednesday afternoon. I have been advised by a good friend of the show, Jordan Cheriton, that trying to do a podcast on Wednesday night, the night before Thanksgiving, when everybody's traveling, probably not the best time to do it.
No, it's terrible.
So Wednesday afternoon, we are going to do a live stream and we are going to have 2 amazing guests.
Wait, what time are we doing this? Because this was new to me.
You have something on? Yeah. No, we were looking at actually 1:00.
It'll be cutting it close. I'm telling you right now. This is like a 2-hour procedure. I'm just telling you. And I had no idea. So,
all right. So maybe we'll make it 1:30.
And we're going to have to push that back. And I'll be like literally just coming in. But, and also next Sunday, mm-hmm. I don't know we don't have anything that's on the calendar, but I have baby shower I have a baby shower Sunday afternoon. Sunday afternoons is hard.
Yeah,
because have stuff.
Well, we'll be cognizant of the time and we'll work around it.
Okay.
There's nothing wrong with that.
I have a baby shower.
So on Wednesday, we are finally going to have a very special guest that we've been wanting to have on for a while. And that, of course, is Ryan Grimm of The Intercept. Woo-hoo! And Rising. So it'll be very interesting to have the conversation, of course, dissecting the Build Back Better bill, which is a joke, among other things. And
he's great.
Yes, he is. And we will very likely have Jordan Cheriton of Status Quo as well. So
it'll be like Journalistapalooza.
It'll be the perfect Thanksgiving gift for all of you guys.
Actual journalists, people.
Real journalists.
People who actually do reporting. I know, it's fascinating. It's like looking at a dinosaur. It's like looking at a relic in a museum.
So we appreciate you guys. Like I said, if you can become a Patreon, that would be wonderful.
It's very helpful, guys. It is.
Change. You know our cause, what we're fighting for here. And then, of course,
we donate to non-corporate candidates mm-hmm. and we donate to local progressive, like not progressive.
tinyurl.com/Hallandale Garden.
Hallandale Garden.
Pitch in if you can.
Anything. Because if they win by December 15th with the good amount of with the most contributions, they'll get the bonus mm-hmm. grant money. So it's a really cool thing they're trying to do there. And it's a very good cause, people. It really is.
So with that said, we really appreciate you all checking in today. It's been a great show and we will see you on Wednesday.
Bye all. Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.